The Laura Flanders Show. This is a place to go for stories of resilience, power shifting, and change rooted in love. This is Leah Penniman from Soulfire Farm.
The Laura Flanders Show is made possible by listeners just like you. You can become a sustaining member and help keep our programming independent, audacious, and ad-free. Go to patreon.com/theLF Show and become a member. And this is the Laura Flanders Show, a TV and radio program that shines a light on the solutions of tomorrow today. We report on the people and movements driving systemic change from the worlds of politics, arts, and entrepreneurship. Welcome. Black, Indigenous, and people of color-led media do work that other media simply don't do. Helping undocumented New Yorkers get vaccinated in Queens. Reporting on Haiti's low death toll from COVID-19. Those are just two examples, and that's just a taste. This week on the Laura Flanders Show, we kick off a new monthly feature we're calling Meet the BIPOC Press. In the hosting chairs, Sarah Lomax-Reese and Mitra Kalita of URL Media. And stick around to the end for my two cents on buried Black history and the revolutionary Memorial Day holiday that might have been.
Hi, I'm Sarah Lomax-Reese, co-founder of URL Media and president and CEO of WURD Radio. We are here as a part of the Laura Flanders family once a month to bring to you information from the URL Media Network. URL stands for Uplift, Respect, and Love. And it's a new media organization where we have a network of BIPOC-owned media organizations that have come together to share stories and to just bring a different perspective on news and information. And today we are going to be celebrating Memorial Day, but from a very different perspective. We're going to be looking at two wars that have impacted the whole world and disproportionately affected communities of color. And those wars are the coronavirus and police brutality and systemic oppression. And so we're going to be talking with two of our URL Media Network partners, the Haitian Times and Sahan Journal, to talk about these twin pandemics, these twin issues, these twin wars. And very excited to be co-moderating and co-hosting this with my co-founder, Mitra Kalita.
Thank you, Sarah, for setting us up and that history lesson that has a direct line to the present day. Memorial Day is also the psychological start of summer, and certainly in the US, it feels like we are ready for summer. Mask policies have been changed. People are back eating indoors in restaurants. Offices are opening up. So there's this weird normalcy that's been resuming. And I think Memorial Day weekend will only hasten that. And yet for some of us, this has been punctuated with our mobile phones teetering, with friends who want to brunch or get back together here in the US, and WhatsApp messages, perhaps from our families thousands of miles away overseas, reporting on friends, family, relatives in places like India, Brazil, and Peru, reports of COVID, desperate pleas for oxygen. In my case, certainly the number of family members with COVID has crossed into the dozens. So COVID is still very much a threat in one part of my life, even as this other part of my life, which is the day-to-day here in America, is very much focused on the reopening. Mukhtar, I'm hoping we can start with you. Sahan Journal was founded to cover immigrant communities and people of color in Minnesota. If you could take us a little bit through your founding story, and then we'll come to the present day.
As you know, Minnesota has a large population of immigrants and refugees and people of color from different parts of the world. And now they make up about 20% of the total state population. But if you pick up the newspaper or tune into the radio, you get the sense that Minnesota is predominantly white. So we really wanted to change that. We had the killing of George Floyd in, almost exactly a year ago. And then we have to pivot and change our, coverage into really bringing all the issues surrounding police brutality, civil rights, and, how the communities were responding to what happened at the time. And we have seen, you know, a convolution of really young people from diverse backgrounds, from, you know, the traditional African Americans and the new African Americans, who are also really kind of joined hands and you know, went out to really protest about things that were affecting their daily lives. Our audience has grown significantly since we have been covering those issues.
Mukhtar, you said something that really was interesting to me when you said, you know, they're African Americans and new African Americans, speaking of the Liberians and Somalis and whatnot. And I'm curious if Black immigrants from Africa and other places see themselves as African American.
I use that term because I think, you know, the more the community establishes its roots in Minnesota, the more, you know, they, I think, identify with the challenges and struggles that the Black African American community really feel. And we have seen, you know, also young Somali men being killed by the police. The case of Dalal Eid, just, you know, a couple of months after George Floyd was killed, happened. And we have seen how everyone came out to really support the family and protest against the killing.
So Gary, I want to bring you in here because Mukhtar mentioned that we've been seeing this for years, and you are the veteran, I believe, among us, because the Haitian Times has been around for two decades. Can you talk a little bit about the police brutality as you've been covering it? I know as a journalist in New York, what I remember looking to the Haitian Times for unique coverage on were the death of Patrick Dorismond, and then, of course, the brutality of Abner Louima. And I wonder how much of what Mukhtar just laid out is familiar to you and whether there was a similar evolution of the community that you've seen.
So I want to first talk about his use of new African Americans, because ultimately you become that. Like, my children are Black. They are Haitian, but they're not separating themselves from who they are, because people, society would not give them any choice. So, and they embrace it rather eagerly. You saw that from the Harlem Renaissance to today. Whoever is the new group that comes in, first you separate, and then you look at the African-Americans as well. They are like me. The other thing that's familiar is the spate of police brutality, the consistency of murdering. The story sort of like that shocked the world before George Floyd was Abner Louima. He was sodomized inside a police precinct in Brooklyn. Really was left for dead. The NYPD has been under federal oversight before because of these patterns. And they were forced to implement some community activities to really show young people how to interact with the police so that these encounters don't become fatal.
What Mukhtar and Gary have been talking about are, you know, the police brutality, and the opposite side of that is police reform. And so we just had a very contentious DA's race. And for Black Philadelphians, it felt like a repeat of the presidential election. It was that important. We had this very progressive incumbent DA named Larry Krasner, who has been a real thorn in the Fraternal Order of Police's side. He has gone against the establishment. He has really advocated for progressive policies. You know, it really came down to the Black community came out. Philadelphia has a Black population of almost 44%. He won handily. He won 65% to 35%. The electorate was smart and savvy enough to kind of see through the narratives that were being advanced by stakeholders like the FOP. And, you know, it really felt very racialized as well.
It's a similar story here in New York, where kind of how much police reform feels like it's on the ballot. And one of our leading candidates is Eric Adams, who is an African-American cop, which makes things very complicated. Gary, I just wondered if you have thoughts on that, because I believe it was the Haitian Times. You recently did a story on how Haitians who are in the NYPD are also being elevated as precinct captains as they're trying to diversify not just the ranks of police officers, but also its leadership. And where does the Haitian community stand on this?
We've had a very complicated relationship with the NYPD, because we've had three of our fellow countrymen victim of the NYPD. Some of the biggest protests over police brutality in the city have been organized by Haitians. And now whenever you see a protest in New York, you see plenty of Haitian flags everywhere. But at the same time, I think, by and large, there's still an element of like respecting the police, from especially from our elders, you know, from people from my parents' generation, you know, you didn't, you know, talk back to the police, or you whatever the police said, you did. And so now we're transitioning to a place where we're taking a more critical look at the police, at the same time respecting policing, because we understand that as a society remains what it is, policing has a place in our society, but it has to be done not to the detriment of the community. It has to be done with respect. And Adam is trying to thread that same needle. I mean, he fancies himself, and he was, to his credit, a very vocal critic of the NYPD from inside when he was a cop. I covered him when I was at the New York Times. So I think that's what he's trying to do right now, and we'll see whether or not that's successful.
This is the Laura Flanders Show. I'm Laura. This time we are kicking off a new monthly feature that we've been calling Meet the BIPOC Press. In the hosting chairs are Sarah Lomax-Reese and Mitra Kalita of URL Media. That's a new network of BIPOC-led and owned media outlets. Mitra is CEO and publisher of Epicenter NYC. Sarah heads up WURD Radio, Philadelphia's black-owned radio station. They're joined by Mukhtar M. Ibrahim, editor and executive director of Sahan Journal, an online nonprofit platform rooted in Minnesota's immigrant population, and veteran award-winning journalist Gary Pierre-Pierre, founder and publisher of The Haitian Times, a Brooklyn, New York-based publication covering the Haitian diaspora since 1999. You can find my interview with Mitra and Sarah about the founding and importance of URL in our archives at lauraflanders.org. That's also where you can sign up for our weekly newsletter so that you get the latest information on our streaming events and uncut exclusives, including my latest with Winona LaDuke, executive director of Honor the Earth. She has a vision of indigenous power sovereignty based on solar and wind power that she'll tell you all about. Next, the Media Roundtable conversation pivots from covering the war against black and brown bodies in the streets to the front lines of the coronavirus pandemic. But first, here's Prosper by Inez Balatier featuring St. James Valsaint and produced by the Guitars Over Guns organization. It's a nonprofit based in Miami and Chicago that's working to empower and create safe spaces for young people to express themselves through music.
No weapons against the people, no weapons against the people, no weapons against the people shall prosper. Tell a friend there's never been a better time to talk about it, walk about it, be about it, organize for the fight of our lives. No slaves, no masters. Say the name, say it now.
Will not be televised. If you want the truth, then you better get up and fight. The politician thought a trick and telling hella lies. Devil might try, but the spirit, it can never die. We the wretched of the earth in search of better life. Reckless when it hurts, we the first to get terrorized. Push when you recognize that chip on your shoulder is a boot on the neck from the troops they pay to serve and protect. Property which we refuse to be, that's why we yell 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12. Runaway slave catchers picking up the prisoner. So niggas better listen up to all the black kids trapped in this nation. Fact is, we facing mass incarceration, funded by the paper chain that we participated in. Wonder why they take away our rights, it's enslaving. I can't breathe, the system is suffocating. I ain't breathe till we all get liberated from masses religion. We call it capitalism. The battles we win, we'll break the shackles of prison. Cause the power of the people.
I wanted to see if we could kind of pivot to that other war that we've all been dealing with, which is COVID-19. And each of you, including you, Mitra, you know, have direct ties to countries and communities that are really still in the throes of COVID-19. And I'm actually going to start with you, Mitra, because Epicenter, your newsletter, has done amazing work around vaccine outreach and COVID-19 awareness and education. And you're also, you know, your family, you have direct family in India. So talk to us about what you're still navigating here in Queens, but also what you're hearing and experiencing with your family in India.
Thank you, Sarah. Well, I do think it's related because there are systems that are set up against our communities. And in so many ways, what we've just heard are our news outlets are picking up the baton of literally defending our communities. And so COVID in many ways, Epicenter's very founding here in Jackson Heights, Queens, where the epicenter of the epicenter, as it's known, really is the result of looking around and asking the question, does anybody know how bad this is? Will anybody come? And then just communities trying to help each other. In more recent months, our community came to us, came to Epicenter. We had been working with a lot of small businesses and spotlighting their problems and their successes. And they said, well, restaurant workers qualify to get vaccinated. Can you help us navigate this? We don't know how to book vaccines because in the kind of infinite wisdom of the vaccine rollout, everything was online. And so Epicenter began an effort, and it was really by word of mouth with these restaurant workers, which then led to taxi drivers, which then led to elderly who might not have access to, like I said, the internet. And as of yesterday, we've helped book 5,037 vaccine appointments. And this really just started out as neighbors helping neighbors, and it grew and grew and grew. That brings us to the present moment and what I sort of alluded to earlier of the schism that many of us are feeling, where it's no longer as hard to get a vaccine appointment or even vaccines as it once was. And yet our families overseas don't have access. And in many cases are dealing with second, even third surges. This is really worrisome to me because it feels like it underscores so much of the systemic inequalities that we've been talking about. And it's not like we can't do something about it. So President Biden has supported sharing the patents and technology transfer with other countries. As a result of the situation that India is in right now, it's kind of saving its vaccines for its own people. But India is also the largest vaccine provider to the rest of the developing world. So we have this terrible domino effect where until Indians are vaccinated, does that mean that the rest of the world has to wait? And so if it sounds complicated, it really is. But it also means that we're not acting like we're one world. We're acting as though, oh, well, the US is going to be okay. And therefore, you know, these variants and this threat is not going to come here. And I can tell you firsthand from here in the epicenter that that is absolutely not true.
Mukhtar, you just recently came back from Kenya. You have family there and you spent a few weeks there. Can you tell us like what your experience was and what's happening on the continent, especially in Kenya?
I went there a couple of weeks after I took my Pfizer shot, you know, so I was grateful to have that vaccine. But when I landed in Nairobi, the situation was completely different than, you know, what I have seen before. As you can tell, you know, Nairobi is one of the most populous, capital cities in the world, 4.2 million people. And the shocking part was, you know, the lack of social distancing in you know, when you're going to the market or, you know, visiting people. I have seen a lot of, you know, deaths happening in Nairobi since I was there. My uncle passed away. And when we went to the cemetery, you can see a lot of, you know, other burials happening around. So the situation was there was really bad. And they were in the surge of, you know, the third wave of coronavirus, and there have been lockdowns during, especially at night. By 8 p.m., you know, you won't see anyone outside. But things were improving after I left, and they extended the curfew until 10 p.m. at night.
Mukhtar, I'm so sorry to hear that. And it just invokes a situation we had this week where my uncle had been in the ICU with COVID, and it was a really rough week because he's one of my closest uncles, my father's closest brother. He was released, and I was kind of breathing easier. And then I got a WhatsApp message from Gujarat, where my husband's family lives, that his cousin had passed. His cousin had been on dialysis, so was, you know, had a comorbidity, which, and then he got COVID. And then within minutes of that, I, you know, you really can't make this up, I got a message from another family group saying my aunt had just been taken to the hospital. And so I do feel like it's been quite relentless, and it's been months of this now. And so to not have access to the vaccines, it's a glaring inequity. And I just am surprised more people are not talking about it.
I'm going to just turn to you, Gary, because as you listen to Mitra and Mukhtar, and I'm sure, you know, you are dealing with similar things what's happening in Haiti and the communities that you're covering. And I'm wondering, like, how does this change how you cover this issue?
Haiti, for once, give us a break. COVID hasn't done much damage to Haiti. And now the question is why? There's a lot of speculation, a lot of scientists, experts who are heading down to trying to figure out what happened there. Although there's a little bit of uptick in the numbers lately. As far as New York, you know, going back to your question about how we reported on it. Well, at first we tried to honor everyone who passed. And then quickly we realized it was a stigma attached to having died of COVID, which shocked us at the newspaper, because we never really at one moment felt there was any stigma attached to it. But because when the AIDS epidemic came about, they said that by the virtue of being Haitian, you were an AIDS carrier. And that really haunted a generation of young people in the schools having to deal with that. So people were very hesitant about identifying as being dead of COVID-related illness.
I wanted to just see, as we get ready to wrap up, final thoughts from everyone. And if there are any big stories that you guys are following as your newsrooms are looking at the landscape.
Yeah, we are gearing up for the 1 year anniversary of the killing of George Floyd. So as a newsroom, we always, you know, center the voices of the community. So we are trying to do something really unique in terms of identifying community members who can, you know, tell us how that date impacted or changed their lives. On the coronavirus, you know, we are doing multimedia production around COVID-19 vaccine in multiple languages, in Somali, Hmong, and Spanish. The idea is to really reach older folks who cannot, you know, read or write in English. And we are also covering, you know, issues happening from other countries and trying to make the global local. One of our latest stories is how the Indian community is, you know, fundraising and providing supplemental oxygen for, you know, their families back home. So I think the two topics that we talked about is something that we cover daily, the coronavirus and issues around police brutality and, you know, racial justice.
Well, for us, we are doing about an 8-part series on the George Floyd, the aftermath of the George Floyd anniversary. One of them is that we're looking at the racial reckoning working underway inside our community, in our own community. Like, you know, in the Haitian community, there are issues with colorism, and we want to hold up a mirror to ourselves and see where we are. We have an essay on immigrant pride, you know, in the way that, you know, people are saying, you know, essential workers are essential. Well, then, you know, now they're not doing us a favor anymore. We matter. We're essential. We're important. So we want to take a look at that. We want to look at how policing is happening. In fact, we started it today with our story about this African burial ground in on Church Avenue and Bedford Avenue, and the history that's there. And we want to look at the way policing is being done in the community. How are they profiling folks now? Because we know it's still happening. It's been very exciting, very tiring, but hey, this is why we went into this business for.
As New York opens up, our labor market and small businesses are being upended like never before. I mean, this year has been a year. So we're really looking at what it takes to get a job right now. And just underemployment in the communities continues to be an issue. We just did a profile of a street vendor who used to be a pharmacist, lost his job in his home country, has been here, couldn't make ends meet, and is now doing some street vending work as a, he's selling masks. And then we'll continue to do outreach on vaccines. The obstacles remain great to get a vaccine in New York, especially if you're undocumented. So we've just been trying to let people know it's free. You don't need your immigration papers, and it is plentiful. So we'll continue to get that message out there.
Yeah, and WURD, we are May 31st through June 1 is the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa race riot. And so we are going to be covering that and really connecting it with the other major government sanctioned bombing of an American city, which was the MOVE bombing in West Philadelphia in 1985. I just wanna like really celebrate this overall conversation because it really points to what we at URL Media and these BIPOC media organizations are doing, covering different stories differently than the mainstream media. And I think it's really important for our stories to kind of be heard and get some visibility. And so I want to thank everyone for the conversation. Gary Pierre-Pierre from the Haitian Times, Mukhtar Ibrahim from Sahan Journal, and my co-host and co-founder, Mitra Khalida, with Epicenter and URL Media. And I'm Sarah Lomax-Reese, co-founder of URL Media and president and CEO of WURD.
Different stories told differently make a difference. Just consider that story about Memorial Day. It was 1865 in May in Charleston, South Carolina, that it had its roots. A full week before President Lincoln declared an end to the Civil War, black people in Charleston were already celebrating the defeat of Robert E. Lee. On May 1st, 1865, they paraded up to a new Union cemetery where black troops who'd been buried in a mass grave had been reburied by black workmen properly. On May 1st, 10,000 black troops with children singing at their front and women with arms full of flowers and wreaths and crosses to decorate the graves went up to the new cemetery and performed a solemn dedication. After decorating the graves, they picnicked and partied and watched their troops, their victorious troops, parade. It was, as David Blight, the Yale historian who found the original records and wrote them up in a book in 2001, wrote, as if the blacks were really marking an Independence Day for the second American Revolution, a revolution from the idea of a superior white race. And just think about it. Since 1865, we could have been celebrating that holiday and celebrating our independence from that idea. Instead, white media, starting in the South and Reconstruction, rewrote the story in their newspapers and everywhere, and we've been basically fighting the Civil War ever since. Now, a pandemic's reminding us that no race is immune from a virus. This is one world, and we better start acting like it. Maybe we could start with this Memorial Day. Thanks for joining our special Meet the BIPOC Press edition of the Laura Flanders Show. For more information on this week's guests, go to patreon.com/TheLF Show, where you will find a rich list of suggested reading, listening, and watching. It's also where you can find an invitation to add your voice to the conversation by joining us Sundays at 11:30 a.m. on our YouTube channel to watch this week's episodes and participate in a live chat with our guests. Subscribe to the Laura Flanders Show channel on YouTube, and you'll never miss a thing. All the details are at patreon.com/TheLF Show. And oh yes, one more thing. We have just days left in our May pledge drive. By Memorial Day, we're seeking to raise $25,000 to fund partnerships like this one with URL. Become part of our Patreon family and make a monthly contribution that helps us to keep this programming coming free to television, radio, and online audiences all across the world. Make a donation today as a monthly supporter and become a Patreon kind of co-producer of this show. We say we're independent, and we are, from government and corporations, but we do depend on your generosity and your caring about the people around you and the conversations that they hear. So how about it? If you are able to make a gift, and maybe you know people who aren't, make a donation on their behalf. Make a donation on your own behalf, perhaps to add some forward-thinking, positive models into your community's media diet. Go to lauraflanders.org/donate to make a one-time contribution or become a Patreon partner at patreon.com/TheLF Show. Huge, heartfelt, forward-thinking thanks to all of you who have already done your bit. You know how precious you are. Thank you for listening. This show's produced by yours truly, Laura Flanders, with Matt Colicello, Jeremiah Cothran, Mercedes Grostiaga, Jeannie Hopper, Nat Needham, Charlotte Carpenter, David Newman, Rory O'Connor, Ryan Hote, Sabrina Artel, and Jeanette Hernandez. Major funding for this program is provided by the Novo Park, Ellen Poss Family, Hisuku Wilson Foundations, the Schumann Media Center, Rising Fund at Tides, Kim Connor and Nick Groombridge, Jane Fonda, and listeners like you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for contributing. Thanks for your ideas. Stay kind, stay curious. Until the next time, I'm Laura.